My God, it's full of stars.
Good afternoon, Hal.
Good afternoon, Mr. Aimer. Everything is going extremely well.
Hello and welcome to episode 193 of the Filmiac Podcast. I'm John.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm JR.
This week we're talking Kevin's pick, a little film called 2010, or 2010, The Year We Make Contact, from 1984, directed by Peter Hyams, starring Roy Scheider, John Lithgow, Helen Mirren, Bob Balaban. This is a sequel of sorts to 2001, so Cara Dulia is also in this. And we'll also be talking other things we watched. I have a lot of things. You guys, not so much. You're not real film fans anymore. You've given up. But I'm still going hard.
We quit, you know? Man. We fucking quit.
Yeah, like, I'm TV all the way now, man.
Oh, I'm so anti-TV. People are trying to get me to watch TV so much, and I'm just like, where is the time?
I watched all of The Underground Railroad since we last recorded.
Oh, my God.
But, I mean, you know, it's a
the
limited
Barry series. Jenkins thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got the Blu-ray because I was like, I'm not watching Amazon, all those fucking ads on this. Mm. And I think you should watch it. I think this is the TV. It's going to make you like TV.
I actually, it's funny you mention that because I've been meaning to watch The Good Lord Bird ever since it came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I downloaded it even. I have it on my Google Drive. I just haven't watched. I've had it for like a year and a half now, 2 years, and I just can't find. It's just so, I mean, wow, it's like hours and hours and hours of content. It's too much. It's too much. Can't do it. I won't. plus, I'm trying to read more, and it's like, you know. Mm. I just bought more books. Like, I gotta relax, dude.
Give up the video games, dude.
I don't have video games. I don't play any video games, JR. That's been done for a while. My PC. I sold my PS5. I have no video. I mean, I do play emulators on my... And I got a new Mac, and it can run some stuff. So I've been playing, like, Sims 4 on it with my kid. She loves that shit. Mm. And I'm about to get Universe Sandbox, probably, for it, because she really wants to play Space Engine again, and I can't play Space Engine because it's a PC only. So get Universe Sandbox, same thing. Anyway,
I know what that is. Yeah,
cool. It's just a game where like you can manipulate all the planets in the galaxy. So you can remove the sun from the Milky Way and see how it affects the planets over time.
I think it would hurt them.
Yeah, it makes them all like ice.
Yeah.
But it takes like 60 years for that to happen. Or maybe even longer.
Interesting question for later.
Mm.
Interesting question for later. What happens if you add a second sun to the solar system? Feels like that would also get complicated. You should have Amelia try that out.
Yes. Yes, it would. Yeah. I will have her do that. We'll recreate this movie's plot. And maybe a little Project Hail Mary in there too. All right, well, speaking of 2010, I mean, unless there's news or something, I don't think there's news. Is there news?
I don't know, we've all been in the dark, man.
Oh,
I didn't have a phone for a week and a half.
You know what, George Miller, pitching his final Mad Max film, apparently, to all the studios.
Oh, yeah.
That's gonna go well.
And he wants to make a TV show, also.
Hmm. Hopefully he'll get somebody else besides Tom Hardy.
I don't think Hardy's part of the picture, right? Like,
did y'all see that whole like drama with Mobland? Like, apparently he was, you know, walked off, unprofessional, blah 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 blah.
I did hear about that. Which is why we probably don't need to hire him again. To work on the I don't know, project of a pretty mercurial filmmaker. Again, that already went poorly.
What they really need is to get a second season of Taboo going. I'd watch that.
Why?
It's good.
Why is that what you would watch?
I would watch Taboo because I've already committed to season one. I watched it. It's good. Did you watch Taboo?
No.
It's good.
Because I can't watch that much TV, so why would I watch that?
Well, this is, I watched it like 5 years ago. I mean, I'm just saying. You know.
I wanted to watch it. I heard good things.
Yeah, it's good. If they came out with a new season of, Deadwood out of nowhere, I'd watch it. You know what I mean? I'm invested. I've watched that show. So
isn't Taboo on like fucking FX or something, which you shit on all the time?
On FX, I think. I shit on it. I shit on the bad shows.
You call it FX trash every time it comes up.
Well, what? How has it come up before? What show?
I don't want to bring it up because you're gonna go on one of your things. You're gonna go on one of your bear things, and I don't want to do it.
Well, I don't like the bear. Anyway, I mean, it's embarrassing. This final season push they're trying to do, it's really cringy.
I didn't watch the previous one, the previous final season.
Who even cares? It's so stupid. Fuck that show.
Well, once there are two seasons of a show that I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. Like, it's never happening.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's over.
Yeah, totally. Well, of course, you might want to watch it as a lead up to the social antics. What's it called?
Reckoning.
Reckoning. Yeah, the social reckoning.
I was right. They need to shout that word in the trailer so we can remember the title.
It's a bad title. It's a very bad title.
Yeah, because was there a reckoning?
Not only that, but it's just like The Social Network. I remember people saying that was a shitty title, but at least that refers to what it is, you know? Like, it's about Facebook, which is the social network, you know? But what is the social reckoning? Like, what does that even mean? The reckoning of being social? It's fucking stupid. Anyway.
I don't know. That trailer was bad, so
yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm gonna end up seeing it anyway. But
I mean, I
don't want to
see it. Yeah,
I'm gonna do it against my will.
It's a must watch, but
Sorkin might like. I just think he kind of sucks right now. Like, he's only directing his own shit, and he has not made something good like directing his own script lately, right?
Maybe ever.
Molly's Game is not good.
I didn't mind Molly's Game, actually, but
I mean, the Trial of the Chicago 7 is worse than Molly's Game.
Yeah.
And I can't remember any others. I'm sure there's one or two from Get
Out. Gotta be something else.
The Lucy, the Ricardos, Being the Ricardos.
He
did that?
Did I just make that up?
I didn't know that. If he did,
I just made that up. I'm sorry. now I feel bad. Yeah, Aaron Sorkin, motherfucker. Sorry, I was talking to myself, not you guys. Yeah.
Well, that is embarrassing. Did he write it?
It would be more embarrassing if he didn't. Honestly, like, he's like, I need to take the worst thing I've ever seen that I didn't even write and direct this. Mm-hmm. That would be bad. He wrote it.
Of course,
those
he did.
Three movies. Molly's Game is the least embarrassing. That's not good.
Well, maybe The Social Reckoning will actually be a masterpiece, you know? Like, it'll really be like, whoa, this guy's been hiding this in the chamber. Just kidding, that'll never happen. So let's talk 2010. This is Kevin's pick. Kevin, you'd seen this before, I believe.
Yeah, so I actually have like a long history with this movie. Like, at some point I guess in the 80s, like, my dad must have had, like, a, I don't know, like a month's worth of paying for HBO. Because he had, like just stacks of VHS tapes with stuff that he had recorded off of there. And 2010 was one of them. So I think I had seen 2001 because, you know, it was space and I was into Star Wars when I was a kid. And so, you know, but but then later seeing 2010 and like, and even now, like every time I watch it, like there was something wrong with the audio tracking on the VHS tape. So like the sound gets like enormously clearer when they've gotten onto Discovery, they've like made it, you know, stop spinning, and they're getting that like bridge between it and the Leonov. So like every time I see the movie, like I'm just like, oh, here it comes.
Nice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is that the only way you've seen the movie, is on VHS?
No. I've seen it on DVD a couple times, and just this last time I watched it, I got the Blu-ray from the library.
Oh, okay. How'd it look on Blu?
Okay. This is one of those weird things with like watching. It's so weird how, like, watching something from, like, so I watched 2001, then I watched 2010. The way it looks, the way it sounds, like, what they did in, you know, 1967 is still, like, light years, pun maybe intended, ahead of what they did in the early 80s. Like, just listening to Hal's voice. Like, they could maybe make the argument that, like, oh, Discovery's been floating in space with no power for blah, 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 blah. So that's why the sound from HAL doesn't sound as good. But, like, y'all could have recorded it better, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
I think not only that, I mean, I feel, I agree with you, like, just filmmaking wise, this film feels dated in a way that 2001 does not at all. And I mean, I know there are things about 2001 that are sort of like the Pan Am stuff and maybe the outfits and some of the scenes, well, before they go to space or before they're actually, you know, in the spacesuit stuff. But for the most part, I feel like it does a really good job of being like timeless in a way. And this film, just from the filmmaking techniques, the fact that they have like reverb on all the voiceover is brutal. And I mean, it just really, really dates it to like even before 84, it feels like. Because like this movie, it feels like it owes so much to Alien. And yet it didn't learn any of the lessons that Alien should have taught it, you know, like to sort of ground it in some sort of reality or make it sort of gritty or dirty or real in some way. And it's unfortunate because it's like there's a lot of talented performers in the film, and I think most of them are doing a pretty good job. I especially liked Helen Mirren and her accent. I thought her accent was just absolutely great. But, and I mean, you know, Roy Scheider's, he's all right. I don't know. I could take him or leave him most of the time. Sometimes he's in something and I'm just like, he's just so like likable and affable, and I like him, his presence on screen. Like, you know, like I love him in Sorcerer, obviously, or even Marathon Man. But like, yeah, this, he's a little bit of a weak central character, I feel like.
I thought he's, I don't know, it's like Scheider at his sort of like shtickiest. Like, he's like, I'm doing my kind of persona regardless of the material, and just did not match the material. I also thought that, like, I was like, did Scheider like influence the screenplay at all? Like when Dr. Chandra, Bob Balaban's character, is like telling him it's his fault. Because, like, he, you know, it's, like, his office that signed off on the orders. And he's like, I didn't know. And it's like, I don't know, man. That fucking Floyd we meet in 2001 would have known, like, that dude was keeping secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, just, like, let your character be the asshole. It's okay.
Yeah, like, you know. I'm sure plenty of people have like torn this movie apart, you know, for the science aspect of it. But like, yeah, like the whole retconning of Hal as, you know, like, oh, he was given conflicting orders and he did his best to interpret them. A supercomputer doesn't know when to just shut up. 'Cause like watching knowing that from like 2010 and then watching, you know, 2001, like Hal's the one bringing it up about, you know, the monolith and about, you know, the secrecy and, you know, this, that, and the other. And then that's when shit starts to go haywire and, you know, he becomes paranoid and, you know, this mission's too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it. Why did Hal bring it up in the first place? It's silly.
I know we're jumping pretty deep into this thing, but I thought the idea of a like redemption arc for Hal was misguided at best. I was like, one, I don't understand why we have to go back to the well with Hal. Like, we can do another Odyssey. We can go back to Jupiter to get the monolith. We don't have to have Hal, and we don't need to redeem him. I say that though. I think my favorite character was actually Bob Balaban. And just whatever kind of like fucking weirdness he was bringing. 'Cause it was weird. And I thought weird, interesting how he thinks of these computers as his children. Although I think he's also fucking Sal. So
without a doubt,
a little bit of a Woody Allen child situation, I guess, but
yeah.
but his sort of like creepy vibe and the way that vibe is commented on by Lithgow and Scheider, I really enjoyed. You're like, put it when he's sleeping. When's that? How would you know?
Well, like, that's the funny thing about that too. It's like, yeah, like, you know, obviously, you know, quote unquote computer nerd talking to computers, you know, living in a kind of, you know, virtual world, but like, I don't know. I think the way Balaban plays him, like, he's not like, well, they never show him like, you know, not indecent. Sleeping or okay. Like, you know, being like, I don't know, like, Chandra's not presented as being, say, I don't know, like, these days, that character would be totally presented as neurodivergent, but I don't think you really have that with the way Balaban is portraying Chandra.
No, I think that they present him as someone more comfortable talking to the computers, to the people, and, against every other sort of like inclination of this movie, yeah, they don't make that super explicit. Because I mean, that's probably my biggest problem with this movie, is that this movie treats me like I'm an idiot constantly. They make everything very obvious and explained to you. To the point where I just felt gross.
I feel by virtue of the fact that it's more like way more plot focused than the original film.
Sure, but even the beginning, like the text recap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you have the text recap, and I think that exists mostly to show us that Scheider is Floyd. And but then gives us a bunch of other information about like what happened to Bowman, how, but like we get all of that again when the Russian scientist comes to talk to Scheider when he's on the big satellite thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why do you have both? Why do you have this expository conversation that recaps things for me immediately after your recap text? Why are you constantly giving me like a visual montage of something that would be cool that I could understand, and then also giving me Scheider's fake voiceover correspondence to his wife or to you know, his colleague who runs the NCSA? Mm-hmm. I can't remember what it's called. But you know, like when Kevin was talking about when they make that bridge between the ships, like I really liked that sequence visually, and I was just getting like the dumbest voiceover that I've ever heard in my life. It's like a kill me now kind of voiceover just to give me some exposition that I just don't need. Because I'm seeing
there's also like, okay. This leads me to the biggest problem that I have with the film, which is it doesn't really lead me there. It's completely unrelated, but Cara Delia being in the film as the, I don't know, disembodied
like, force ghost.
Yeah, force ghost of his character from 2001. I don't know. Like it's like they were trying to get at the sort of esoteric spirituality or whatever of the first film, but they never get close to it. And honestly, a lot of it comes off as like really corny, and like the when he brushes his mother's hair and all that.
It looks so bad.
It does, and it's a scene where like I can imagine that in literature form being like a really beautiful scene. Described in a book, in the book that this is based on, but like in the film, it's just like that shows you the level that we're working with Peter Hyams. He doesn't know to change that. He thinks no, we need to see the hair being brushed by a disembodied brush handle. You know, and it's just like, you know, it's not going to look good. It's going to look ridiculous and silly, and people, it's going to take people out of the film. But he doesn't understand that. Like he's not, because he's the director of Sudden Death and
why
Outland? Yeah, you know, Outland's actually probably one of his better films.
Why do we need Bowman on Earth at all? Why does Bowman?
I agree.
I thought that was a strange choice. I also. The way the scenes are put together, I couldn't decide if this was intentional. The blast that kills Max, the German guy who goes out in the pod. The Russian.
Mm.
Or a cosmonaut who goes out in the pod. It's like that energy blast that destroys his pod. We mm-hmm. see that blast heading towards what looks like Earth. So is Bowman's like... spirit energy inside of that blast.
That's what I got.
Was the blast not really meant to kill Max? And that was just sort of like happenstance, or not? Well, happenstance would be a really dark way of putting that. Mm. Happy accident.
It was incidental.
Yeah. Right. So it was incidental to Bowman going to Earth just so he can like creep out his ex-wife and creepy brush his mom. Before he comes back to the, you know, to the ship much later. It's just these two isolated moments at once. And then we get him where, if we're going to have him, it's where we should have him, which is on the Discovery.
That's what I mean, though. It feels like those are moments that are in the book. And that Hyams feels, you know, tethered to that narrative. Oh, well, this is great stuff. We've got to have Bowman going to Earth. We've got to have him visiting his wife and his mother and have closure for that character, this beloved character from 2001, which, to be honest, no one gives a fuck about. No. Like, Bowman's not a beloved character, you know? Like,
no.
Hal is the character. So I understand why they
open the pod bay doors. That's it.
Yeah. But like, I understand the compulsion to bring Hal back. I'm with you though. I feel like it should be like Hal should not be in this movie. Even you could do something like what they did at the beginning where he's talking to Candace Bergen's computer, the Sal, and just have like a different version of that same computer and a new, like you say, a new Odyssey, a new mission or whatever. It doesn't have to be so related to the first, but that's, again, that's Clark's fault too, you know, for connecting it so heavily to that first film and the first book and everything.
I do not want to read this book. I don't plan on reading this book, but I am curious how connected he made them, because 2001 is not a book, right? Like, he helped come up with the story, didn't he?
He
novelized it after.
Well, they were developing the same time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and like, he intentionally made stuff in the book different. Like, they go to Saturn instead of Jupiter, and like, you know, some other stuff.
Good for him. I just was like, if the book is also disconnected, it's still kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, 2010 is very, the book, it's been a million years since I've read it, but like, the book is basically the movie, and you know, it's the book is a sequel to 2001, the movie, as opposed to 2001, the book.
Yep, and embarrassing.
Yeah. And for extra fun, I never read this one, but the last one, 3001, they revive Frank Poole.
Okay.
Who's been, you know, frozen in, you know, for 1,000 years.
Hey, if there's anyone you remember fucking less than Bowman, it's that other guy on the ship that just looked like Bowman but had a different name.
Right.
Yeah.
Guy who was in Star Trek.
I read the synopsis for 3001 and just like where it goes. And I was just like, this is like, and I mean, I don't have a huge amount of respect for Arthur C. Clarke as a writer. I mean, I've read a lot of his short stories and I'm very impressed with like his abilities or his ideas, really. I think there's one that's amazing, but like the rest of them are sort of like, eh. But like, yeah, 3001 just sounded like a nightmare. Like, I was like, who would want to read this? Like, I don't know.
And the stuff of his that I've read that is good, which I would call the first two Foundation books good. I would call Rendezvous with Rama, the first one, good.
Did you say first two Foundation books?
Yeah.
You mean Asimov?
Asimov.
Oh, is that Asimov? Oh my God, I'm on Asimov. Yeah. Oh, that's embarrassing.
Have I read? Go home, fucking... JR. You're drunk.
I know.
You said Rendezvous with Rama. That's him.
Yeah. Like, I like that. I've never read the sequels, which I'm sure get increasingly ridiculous. But like, this is not an author who's interested in people, right? Like, there are no memorable characters in Rendezvous with Rama. There is not even really like memorable human conflict. It's all about this big spaceship and the exploration of that spaceship. The way that 2001 plays out, like, I see similarities there where it's like, we have this, what happens in that film is like, it's bigger than individual conflict. There is, of course, individual conflict in the second half with, you know, a computer and the two people that make a decision around that computer. But otherwise, it's all very like, it's like literally galactic. It's huge. And the idea of this author coming in his, you know, later age and like trying to write a touching scene of an astronaut, a dead astronaut combing his mother's hair is just like, it's so gross. Like, this is probably not your lane, dude.
It's also stuff like the way the movie starts. It's, you know, as again, I'm further removed from it because I watched it last week or the week before. It was a minute ago, June 3rd. Yeah, so like 2 weeks ago, and but like there's the like voiceover of Bowman at the beginning saying that goofy line that he keeps repeating. My God, it's full of stars.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, when it first happened, I was like, oh, that's interesting, because it's over black screen. And I was like, that reminds me a lot of how, like, the Dune films start. Like, they start with that quote, you know, over black. And it's just, but it's in a different language, which is cool, too. But then he keeps saying it. And then they have, I think they have, like, a recording of it or something like that. And it's just... Yeah, and it's like, again, it's got that like nasty reverb on it, that like late 70s soap opera reverb, just bad. And I don't know what the it feels like they're trying to get at, again, that sort of like, oh, it's so opaque, like what does he mean, what's full of stars, oh, it's so weird and crazy and creepy, but it's just like it means nothing, like at the end of the day, like, you know, it's just, you feel like it's just Peter Hyams jacking off in the, you know, coffin of Kubrick, and it's just, I don't know. It's really, it's just depressing, because it's like, it could have been something interesting, possibly, with maybe a more competent filmmaker at the helm. And he also acted as his own DP. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think is pretty rare for this time period, but I don't think it looks bad, and I think some of the effects are actually quite good.
I agree with that. And before we started this review, I was kind of wondering, like how's this going to go? Because, like, regardless of whether we like it or not, it's just, it feels so hard to talk about it outside of the shadow of 2001.
True.
Because the film does so much to connect itself to, you know, such an important giant movie. But I also, like, I like the sets that are clearly ripping off Alien. You know, I love that sequence where they build the bridge between the ships, and they are on, like, I don't know, the fucking ski lift between the Lenova and the Discovery. I thought that looked cool. I thought like the pixelated monoliths as they multiply on Jupiter looked cool. Like, I liked a lot of the way this stuff looked. It just, it doesn't look as good as the movie that came out 20 years before it, but it does look cool.
Yeah.
How come when he's explaining, I don't remember what he's explaining, honestly. Roy Scheider's talking to Helen Mirren, and he's explaining some sort of space, you know, something. And he lifts up a pin, and he lets it hang in the air, because it's zero G. Why aren't they floating? Like, how come nothing else is floating? Just a pin.
I have questions about this. He's explaining how we're going to use the Discovery to be, like, the propulsion to get us away from Jupiter.
Right.
That's like the
right.
Two pins connected to each other.
Yeah.
It is weird, and it's like the only other character that we ever see deal with zero G is Bob Balaban. It's kind of a raw deal having to do that. Did you guys notice in the computer room where he's like being turned over by the wires? He's so obviously like straining because he has to like do the typing on the computer in zero G, but he's like very much like holding his head up, like. There's core strength being used. But he might, you know, everyone might have those boots like in 2001 that kind of keep them bolted to the ground. Remember, like the server woman who's
the grip shoes.
What the fuck happened to her?
On the actual ship, it says
that girl died.
On the actual ship, it was like a centrifugal sort of situation, right? Like a like it was spinning and creating gravity.
That girl was on Floyd's ship. That's right.
That girl, she was on the Pan Am flight or whatever.
So you're right. And the Lenova is constantly spinning.
Yeah.
So why is the pins floating? That's what I don't understand.
Maybe it's our zero G desk. You know, we've got one zero G desk in this room.
Zero G desk.
Yeah.
The political stuff on Earth, like the, you know, how the United States and Soviet Union are about to go to war, similar to the film ISS that came out a few years ago, where they're on the space station and then Russia and America go to war and they like have to kill each other. The astronauts. I don't know. I know you guys didn't see it, but anyway.
I certainly did not.
It's not. What did
you guys think of that Time magazine cover?
That's brutal, dude. That was the worst part for me.
Earliest use of AI.
And honestly, I mean, overall, I wrote the year for this movie as 2010. LOL. It's 1984. Sorry. I wrote 2010, directed by Peter Hines. Overall, I guess I like a little bit dull. Like, I probably had the reaction to this movie that most non-movie people would have to 2001. That it's just slow and sort of boring. You know? And again, I think that's unfortunate because has a lot going for it. But I don't think it's successful. And I don't like the plot machinations of like where it goes towards the end. The whole thing about, you know, don't come to this planet or whatever. Like, I don't know. It's just utopian. I don't care about that. I don't know. I don't want any sort of a reveal to the mystery of what the monolith is. I don't need that. I don't want it.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't even know. Is the reveal that the monolith basically fostered life on Earth? Like, in 2001, it appears and it seems to help them with tools.
Increases, yeah, evolution, right? And intelligence, right?
Yeah, the monoliths but it will also create stars. Apparently the monoliths can do anything because they're tools of like this, disembodied super intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that comes out in 2061.
What?
The third book.
The other books.
Jeez, yeah. What? How many of these are there? What the fuck is happening?
There's four. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I read 2061, and by the time I got through with it, I was like, I'm done.
Can't do it.
Published in 87. Okay, and 2010 was in 82.
Yep.
My god.
It's full of stars.
3001 was 97. Can you guys believe Arthur C. Clarke was still alive in 97? Like, I don't even know how old he was. It feels like he's part of a generation that was dead before then. And he
wasn't. That was like the time for him, for me, man. Because that was like when Mysterious World was running reruns constantly on History Channel and Discovery Channel. His show about, yeah. it was like proto Ancient Aliens, essentially.
Great.
Incredible, you know?
Yeah. He was 80 when 3001 was released. Hmm. Like, that's, not crazy.
I mean,
he died in 2008.
Didn't Pynchon just write another book and he's like 940 or something?
Who?
Thomas Pynchon.
God, Thomas Pynchon's alive.
He just wrote a book. You read his book.
What? Oh.
Shadow sorry. Ticket, dude.
My brain did Thomas Wolfe.
Oh.
Who is dead.
Sure. Pynchon is alive. He's just very old.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yeah, Pynchon's 89. Sorry.
Yeah, it's insane.
That book was pretty good.
That's great. I got a lot of Pynchon to read before I can get to Shadow Ticket. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, I'm out of notes for this one.
I have not consulted my notes. Should I run through them in order? Kid, you don't wash hands before eating after hand feeding the fucking dolphins.
Yes. Gross. Good point. Yeah. Not bad.
Did you ever man. Dr. Floyd sitting on the beach with that personal computer drinking a or with a crush can of Budweiser, that was a wild shot that, again, I feel like Roy Scheider had a hand in.
What if I'm drinking beer during this?
Yeah, you know, when I'm training to...
Nice, crisp, cold one sounds good.
But yeah, I think I agree that Mirren is great, and I really liked her accent. I don't think... I mean, is this the only time she's done a Russian accent?
Was she in... it wasn't her in Red Sparrow, was it? Was it like Charlotte Rampling or somebody in Red Sparrow?
Yeah. Mm. She's in Red. She's not like a Russian in Red, right? Probably. I think she's
never
British.
Seen that one.
Red, stupid. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, Charlotte Rampling in Red Sparrow, my bad.
Sorry, I have one more thing, and it just left me. Whatever. I think it, like, Helen Mirren's worst moment is when she's the one who's like, Max, you're going out there, or Brevlovsky or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, like, when he dies, she's, like, so upset. It's like, everyone told you this would happen. Like, how are you sad? Why are you surprised?
Yeah. Dumb. Oh, that's what it is.
Did we say John Lithgow's name?
I said John Lithgow's in the very beginning. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that they try to develop some sort of like friendship between him and the Russian guy.
Yeah. Like.
But it may kind of, I don't know, it goes nowhere, I guess. But
did either of you rewatch 2001 for this?
I did.
I did not have time. Okay. That's not true. I probably could have squeezed it in, but I just didn't. Whatever.
I did, because, you know, it's been so long since I've seen it, and that was a good idea. Like, glad I did that. Mm-hmm. Improved, you know, because I'm so smart. I don't think that movie's one of the best ever, so it improved in my estimation a little bit.
You goof.
But I saw that Steven Spielberg is on an episode of The Rewatchables for 2001 that came out like 2 weeks ago. And I haven't listened to it yet, but because I, you know, I just wanted to wait until we had our conversation and I will go back and listen to it. But that made me want to watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind, because I was like, those may be like related in some way. And they're not super related in terms of just, you know, space. But I was kind of like working on this theory that, like, Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, is it just a really like crummy mix of like, or an attempted mix of these two ideas, sort of like the heady kind of out there space odyssey plus, you know, the sort of like Steven Spielberg, you know, humanism. But then I was like, no. It's actually just like a shitty version of 2010. That's what Interstellar is.
No, Nolan.
He was going for 2010.
I think Nolan, Interstellar is a great example actually of what Hyams is doing wrong, where he doesn't understand what's interesting about his story. Nolan's the same way. Like Nolan doesn't understand what's interesting about the story of Interstellar. What could be interesting about it, and instead focuses on the human drama. He's like the opposite of Arthur C. Clarke. You're saying Arthur C. Clarke's not interested in characters. Nolan's too interested in his characters, and he thinks that we want to see Matthew McConaughey crying his eyes out at the end of this movie because of his decision that he made. None of it makes any sense, and you know, motivationally. And yeah, that's a great connection, actually. It really feels similar for me to 2010, just the sort of missed opportunity that is something like Interstellar, where he's got this massive budget behind him, he can do anything he wants, and he churns out this fucking slop.
And Nolan is also like he's an over-explainer, you know, through dialogue, even though that dialogue is often like nonsensical. This is like one of the things with Inception, like,
right.
He, instead of like not trying to explain it, he can't let his characters just shut up. Right. Mm-hmm. We can't have a second to just like look at things. Someone's always just giving us a gobbledygook explanation of something.
So it's real bad in The Prestige also, having just rewatched that not too long ago. I mean, just the amount of... He'll visually explain something. He knows how to direct the scene. Like, he'll show you what it is, and then he's got a character yapping in the background the whole time about what you're looking at, as if you need to be explained every little thing. And it's like, it's the same thing as like Haim's. Like, they're both just overly concerned with the plot of their films, making sure, and Nolan maybe more so, that the plot somehow loops around and makes sense, which, you know, it always falls short of.
Or at least just loops around.
Yeah. And the thing is, this is crazy, is like, I don't know how you guys feel. I don't know. We've talked about like Nolan in general, but like, for me, like, Dunkirk is his most successful film. And I think it's because it's so sort of like languid and plotless by comparison to everything else, you know, and you're not focused on any, like, there's no character. Yeah. Like, that's such a memorable character. It's about a group of people. It's about this thing that happens, and they're trying to get this thing accomplished, and whether or not they can, the struggle. But it's not like a, you know, there's no like human, I don't know, like super focused drama or anything. So
I've been saying about like the last time I watched the Batman trilogy, it's like every single movie, somebody says something at the beginning, we see it play out, and then somebody has to, then another character has to repeat it to make sure that we got the lesson. And there's so many interviews of Nolan talking about, you know, like, you know, oh, I don't feel like I should, sometimes the audience is just going to be left behind. Like, that's just a thing that's going to, like, no.
He's never left the audience behind. He's never even tried to do that.
If you're left behind in a Christopher Nolan movie, then you're not watching it.
Right. Well,
no, I mean, and you know, I think people were certainly confused by Tenet, but that's because in the theater they couldn't understand it, like literally, like the words, the dialogue, the sound mix. But I also think, like, Nolan is, he's often trying to leave us behind with Inception and Interstellar and Tenet specifically, because he thinks if he just throws like nonsense tech jargon at us, that it's smarter. And it's not. And like, that's not the fucking point. But yeah, I mean, I think all of his movies, like those three plus the Batman movies, it's just like, the higher concept his stuff gets, I do think the worse it gets. And now, I have historically really liked The Prestige. It's been a long time since I saw it, but that was kind of always one of my favorites. Disappointed to hear that that doesn't work.
I mean, and, not for me. I don't know. You know.
And
well, the last time I watched The Prestige, I remember really liking it, but I think I was riding a high from Hugh Jackman having just watched The Fountain. Mm-hmm. And like, they're made around the same time, so.
It's true. Yeah. I could see that. I could see getting into it because of that.
And Rebecca Hall, she's great in it. Even though she's like totally unsung hero of that movie.
Yeah.
This was like a pretty pro Oppenheimer podcast, I remember.
I liked Oppenheimer.
Which is, again, like a more straightforward historical story, though. I mean, I think part of my issue was it was kind of intercutting too much. But
something we didn't mention at the top of the podcast, news-wise, having to do with Nolan, The Odyssey got the R rating.
Oh yeah,
so
that's great.
I'm into that. Like, I'm very interested to see. I'm interested to see
Siren's boobs.
Well, not just Nolan doing an R, doing a hard R historical epic like that. Seeing how, because he's a practical guy, like, right? So like, he'll use practical blood, possibly, things like this. They won't use CG for these things, which will be interesting. And I'm just, it's really the test, like, because The Odyssey, it doesn't look good so far, and if it is, it'll be really you know, it'll be really exciting if that's a good movie.
I remain open-minded. I'm so happy to like shit talk what seemed to be Nolan's biggest successes, and like, every time this comes up on the internet, I want to scream when it is mentioned, like all the movies that he has on the IMDb top 250, which is apparently like just a thing that is voted on by fucking children and idiots. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
But another thing, John, is I do think that you and I are poorly set up for the Odyssey, because as two of the roughly 200 people that have seen the return, I just like, I don't know, like, are they going to be able to capture that as well as Umberto Pasolini did? Because I don't know, Reef Island was fucking good.
I completely agree.
What they did on that island, like, yeah, nothing that I've seen from like Robert Pattinson's scenes on that island, like in that castle, look as good as what we saw in the return.
I agree. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what Robert Pattinson's doing in this movie. It's
looks like a trailer.
It's so bad, dude. Looks
like a lot.
No, I agree. 100%. I think the casting in that movie is way more inspired, and the, again, I just go back to that dog scene. It's so devastating. Like, I don't want to see them try to recreate that in this. Like, it's,
well, the dog's in the trailer, dude. The dog's in the trailer.
It's gonna be so embarrassing.
sorry, we got way off.
Yeah, I know, we really did. So 2010. what's the, you guys got ratings or?
Yeah. Should throw it out there. It's 2.
Kevin, I'm sorry. It's a 2 for me also. I'm so sorry.
Well, I'm sticking with the 4 that I gave it whenever I last watched it before this. I have history with the movie, sure, and like I really like the acting in it. Like, Helen Mirren's great. John Lithgow is great. I think Bob Balaban is great too. On its own, like, if you can somehow like make a hard separation between this and 2001, I think it works on its own. But in tandem, you know, as a sequel and as a continuation of the story, no, it doesn't work. But
I wish I could separate them.
I like it.
Boring.
Yeah.
I wish I could. I wish that I had somehow seen this before ever seeing 2001. Because it's like giving it a 2, I feel mean to the cool things that are in this movie. And I didn't spend a lot of time on those cool things, but there are cool things.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, like, you get, you know, you guys make 100% valid points all through our discussion. So like, I can't fault you for, you know, your rating. So,
Kevin, I don't remember what the homework was. What was the homework?
It was weekend. And I have the DVD, the Criterion DVD, mm-hmm, sitting on my shelf, but this, like I said, the last couple weeks have been like, I ended up working a whole extra day to cover a staff shortage, and like, yeah, you know, we're in summer, so we're like, mm-hmm, busy, and so
that's
like
fine.
Yeah, so I will watch it because I've been interested in watching this, you know, for like a long ass time after, you know, seeing the poster on your wall forever. And you know, I think, you know, I always think like, at somehow there's going to be a Godard movie that I like. And I, you know, maybe like, it's this one.
I do think that this is more likely to be one than most others, but it's also not a movie where, like, if you're not feeling like you should turn on a movie, going in feeling like you're being held hostage by this would not be fun at all.
Yeah. I mean,
well, I will say this, for next time, if you're committing to watch it for next time, then I'll just, if it's okay with you guys, we'll just make this my my homework as well, and I'll watch it also.
Have you never seen it?
I have.
Okay, great.
I own the poster. I have a poster to a movie I haven't watched on my wall.
Yeah, poster.
Yeah. I'm
yeah.
You know, that's you a like certain, Godard named kind of movies.
I know some people would do that. I probably would have done that when I was like a teenager. I would have had a poster like that before I had seen the film.
we used to go take the free posters from Major Video, which were always the shittiest movies.
Right.
You know, that none of the other staff members wanted to take home.
Right.
So I had like Beverly Hills Chihuahua on my college apartment. I had all kinds of shit.
I thought you said shitty movies. just kidding. Okay. So that'll be the homework will be the weekend by Jean-Luc Godard. And let's get into what we watched, other stuff we watched. Who wants to kick it off?
I'll go ahead since I only watched one other movie. So I I rewatched Night on the Galactic Railroad, Japanese anime about two cats exploring the universe on a train. Really depressing ending. I remembered what was gonna happen like at the end, and I still like cried several times during this movie, so it went up to a 4.5. I got my brother to watch it, and he, you know, I understand I had a problem with it the first time I watched it. He wasn't crazy about all of the like Christian stuff that's in the movie. But this time around, I could let that go and just really be moved by these two people being friends and dealing with loss and grief.
And it's like super Christian and Japanese.
Yeah.
It's like not a common combo. All right.
Well, like it's. I don't know. There's a thing towards, this isn't going to spoil too much, but like there's a part where like they're on the train and all of these people are disembarking because they're going to the Christian heaven. But then later on, a character sees the true heaven. So you can take that, and it's not explained, like, is it, you know, the Buddhist, is it the whatever, so you can kind of take that as you want to, in my opinion.
And why? I'm curious about this. I'm going to put it on a watch list. I want to see it. Why does this pink cat have hair like this? Why did they do that?
It's Japan, man. I don't know.
I'm wondering if I could ever get used to that. I don't know.
Well, not only that, like the main character is named Giovanni. And his best friend is Campanella. Yeah. Campanella. Yeah, so... yeah.
It says it's Japanese. It's based on a Japanese book, children's book?
Yep.
Interesting. And the director, Gisaburo Tsuji, directed the other deep dive that we did, Street Fighter 2.
Oh, God.
Okay. Wow.
Notoriously bad.
Don't love that.
Well, that's this just, movie is better than Street Fighter 2.
This is, wait, higher Kevin, rated on his more popular on his thing.
Yeah, Kevin, click Gisaburo's name directly below Night of the Galactic Railroad. There's a 2012 movie called The Life of Midori Gosuku with a cat that looks the fucking same.
Could be the same. Could be a companion same piece. You never know.
This guy can only draw one kind of cat.
Goodness gracious me.
I don't know. You might have to check it out.
Yeah.
I know we did this before, but like I just can't stand that there's a movie called Street Fighter 2 5.
V?
Yeah.
5. Street Fighter 2 5.
Oh. It makes even more sense.
It's a show.
This is The Life of Midori is also based on a book by Kenji Miyazawa.
Oh, okay.
Who wrote Night on the Galactic Railroad. So
perfect.
Oh, God. All right. At least it's the same author or an illustrator for this cat.
Indeed.
All right. That makes it more acceptable. I can breathe again.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
All right.
Yeah. He also did a Lupin movie.
It's true. Nice. I watched John Travolta's directorial debut, Propeller One Way Night Coach.
Oh no.
Okay, look. This movie is 1 hour long. I will say you should watch this movie. I did not give it a passing rating. I gave it a 2.5 out of 5. I didn't love it, but I really sort of respect what it's doing and trying to do, which is just tell a really wholesome story with absolutely zero conflict about a kid who loves fucking airplanes, you know, who's obviously a facsimile of himself at this age, although he's named Jeff. And he goes with his mother on their first plane ride across country to Los Angeles, where she's planning to be an actress. And it's just, you know, sort of a, you know, like you would almost think of this as like a Disney one-off TV movie or something. And it's produced at about that level, which is sort of the what takes away from it, you know, is the fact that it's just doesn't look great. It's not shot great. There are obviously a lot of like corners cut for budgetary reasons. At the beginning of the film, you see like the actual plane they're getting on, some kind of old, you know, prop plane, and it's cool. It's like, oh man, it's like a big plane they're getting on, this old fashioned plane. It must be one of his planes. You know, he owns planes. It must be one of his planes. But then it's like, later on, like, you never see the plane again. Like, it's all CG after that. And it's, like, bad CG, you know what I mean? Because it's like, clearly they were just, like, in a time crunch and they didn't have the means to get it done correctly. But other than, I don't know, I just don't, I can't hold it against it too much because I'm just, you know, he's just working with what they're giving, with what Apple is giving him or whoever. I don't know, did Apple produce this or did he, like, do it on his own? Do you know this, JR?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't have any idea either. And he narrates the whole film, which I think probably turns a lot of people off, but I think his voice works for it pretty well. Yeah. There's a scene in a hotel where, like, this just shows, like, Travolta's not a director, you know? Like, he's never directed anything. He doesn't know what he's doing. He shoots at a low angle because it's a kid, you know, but he's like looking up at the kid, and then on the ceiling you can see like modern cameras and things, you know, these devices that are in modern hotels, and it's supposed to be, you know, 1962 or whatever. And then like there's a, like the door handle on the hotel room door is just like so modern, polished nickel, you know, just one of these. It doesn't look right at all, you know. It just looks like they had no money to dress this hallway.
Do you think that he was like, we're just gonna like CG touch up all this?
I know, that's what, not I, when I watched, I was like, what, how much would it, could it possibly have cost to erase these things digitally? It feels like something I could do on my Mac, you know, like you could literally just like go into DaVinci Resolve, get your, you know, Apple Pencil and just scrape it away, you know. I don't know why they didn't do it. I don't know. I mean, who knows? It all got past a lot of people. But overall, it's not a great film. It's kind of a poorly made first attempt, but again, there's no reason not to watch it. It's 1 hour long, you know, and it's a great addition to your 2026 list, JR.
Besides all the negative things you said. Right? Well, so, those are the reasons to not watch it.
No, but I think it's admirable that, you know, what he's doing here. That's all.
Okay.
I don't think it's good. It didn't work, but it's very admirable. And I'm not a Travolta hater. I don't know, like, he comes out on the red carpet with his beret and his glasses. Everybody hates his guts all of a sudden.
I don't hate him.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, a lot of people, the vitriol from the online community about this,
people just want to look for stuff to hate, like, you know, mm-hmm. Obsession, you know, did super great, and now everyone's like, oh, the girl didn't get paid enough, the art director didn't get paid enough, and it's like, the budget was $750,000, like, what magic money coming out of the air did you expect them to get?
I think you could make back end deals with these people, though.
I would love for the way that, you know, movies kind of profit share to change, but you know, it doesn't. And if Obsession made, you know, $25 million, this woman never would have said anything, because, you know, she knew she was taking a non-union job with a young filmmaker, and that's just kind of what she was doing. Mm. Anyway, I might go see that movie tomorrow. Mm. Obsession, not John Travolta's movie.
Yeah,
it's not in theaters.
I know.
John Travolta's.
I mean, I could still go down to my basement to watch John Travolta's movie, but
that is true. JR?
All right, we'll talk about a movie. I watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind, as I had mentioned, and wanted to bring this up because I don't think we've ever talked about this movie on the show. Is that true? Like, you guys haven't rewatched this in like the past 10 years, right?
I thought I had, but apparently I didn't.
I have never seen this.
Okay. Cool. This is one of those Spielberg movies that I saw in high school and thought it was good and was like, cool, great. You know, it was in my top five on my Spielberg rankings, but, I loved this movie. And I think the first like 30 minutes, which is like a very clear like first act, are incredible. And I started this movie one night and continued it the next day. And when I continued it the next day, I actually just I didn't continue it. I started it over because I wanted to watch the beginning again because I just liked it so much. It is so like wildly entertaining the way this movie gets set up. Bob Balaban, big episode for him. he's there, translating for Francois Truffaut.
Yeah.
Who is like, for some reason, this guy was cast as like the leading like alien scientist. And it's almost like a joke throughout that this guy does not speak English. Like, why did we hire him? And like, I remembered sort of like the setup of this movie, and I remember the end of this movie. Just like, there are brief famous images of like the spaceships. And I forgot completely or never realized how just like interesting the middle of this movie is. And it's not just interesting because, you know, like Richard Dreyfuss is like, becomes a sort of like deadbeat dad, and his family ends up leaving him because of his obsession and stuff. And like, that is good. But there's a lot. I loved every second of this. This is now my favorite Steven Spielberg movie. I want to watch it again because apparently there are three different versions. Oh. And I believe I watched the director's cut. So, highly recommend, John, that you check out this movie that I know you'll never watch.
I was curious about it years ago, and then Jonathan watched it and he liked it, but I was like, oh yeah, and I was sort of like asking him about it, and like the more I asked him about it, the less he seemed interested in it. And I was just like, oh well, maybe it's not that great. And it sort of turned me off at the time, but I don't have any sort of like, I don't care about aliens very much, and like, Spielberg's not a big guy for me. Like, I'd never seen a lot of his stuff. I didn't see AI. I didn't see, you know, his early Sugarland Express or Duel or these kinds of. I've never seen any of this stuff. So,
and I have seen those things, and I just generally don't hold Spielberg in as high regard as most people, but I know that is, you know, higher than you do, for sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think that you'll like Disclosure Day, right? Like, if you go see the movie, I don't think you'll like it. And there are a lot of things about it that work for me that as I'm watching it, I'm like, yeah, a lot of people are going to totally not like this. It's like Steven Spielberg has kind of sold me on a concept that is not going to work for everyone. But Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I think it is a very different animal. It is not like a sort of treacly humanism that I associate with like E.T. and some later things for Spielberg. It is like kind of mean and funny and just structurally very cool and looks incredible. Mm. Like absolutely looks incredible.
Shot by Zsigmond.
Won an Oscar for it.
Nice.
Yeah, all right. I'll watch this piece of shit.
It's funny, like, I've been, you know, because of Disclosure Day, you guys probably have too, like, there's a bunch of, like, Spielberg videos out where he's, like, talking about various things, and, like, apparently he was turned down for Bond twice, and there was another story, too, where, like, when they wanted to use the tones from Close Encounters, Cubby Broccoli was like, hey, you know, can we use them? And Spielberg was like, you know, I'd love to direct a Bond movie. And Cubby Broccoli was like, oh, we don't need them that bad.
Right.
but he let him use them just, you know, just to be nice.
He wrote Close Encounters by himself?
Yeah, I was on the Wikipedia. There's sort of like a development thing. Like, uh-huh. This was his story, and he had Paul Schrader write it. And he fucking hated what Paul Schrader did.
Oh, I see.
And hired John Hill to rewrite it.
Mm.
And still was not happy. So just did his own thing. Honestly, like, I'm surprised. Usually when there's that kind of thing where, like, there are, we'll call them like failed drafts, someone still gets a credit. Mm, like there's enough story.
Yeah.
But yeah, just Spielberg. I don't know how
he rarely writes Schrader off. Really weird.
I think it would be like totally, well, maybe not totally, but like Spielberg and Schrader, I don't see those two meshing well. I don't know. Maybe it's just because like the last like few years, like, you know, Schrader's like really like curmudgeonly about most things, but like the guy who I could never see, like Spielberg could not do a Taxi Driver, you know, obviously not Taxi Driver itself, but like something that like tone. You know what
he's
I mean?
He's not cynical. He's like a totally uncynical, like childlike almost with his, I mean, like what film of his is dark at all, even? I mean, Munich, I guess. Schindler's List is dark, but it's like, it's hopeful also. It's like it's this weird two-tone, you know? Yeah. It's like he wants to have his cake and eat it too. That's one of the big problems that I have with him. It's just like, he wants to have this gratuitously violent picture, and then he won't, you know, oh, but it's okay at the end. He, you know, Schindler feels bad, and he wanted to save more people with his watch. And it's like, I don't know, man.
So check this. Yeah, I get that. And that hasn't gone away, really. But Schrader submitted his script, which Spielberg called one of the most embarrassing screenplays ever professionally turned into a major film studio or director, and a terribly guilt-ridden story not about UFOs at all.
Schrader rocks. I bet it's amazing.
The script's protagonist was a 45-year-old Air Force officer named Paul Van Owen, who worked with Project Blue Book. His job for the government is to ridicule and debunk flying saucers. One day he has an encounter. He goes to the government threatening to blow the lid off to the public. Instead, he and the government spend 15 years trying to make contact. So, like, I get why Schrader didn't have a story credit or anything, because that is very much not what is, like, none of that is anything. like Close Encounters, besides, you know, Contact. Not sure what happened with the John Hill draft. Yeah, I think there have been a couple that Spielberg has had a story credit for and then had someone else write it. Like, he definitely did that with Disclosure Day. That is his story that he asked David Koepp to write for him. And like, he's done a lot of interviews in the past couple months about Disclosure Day. Like, apparently he basically writes like a 50-page treatment of a story and then gives it to whoever he wants to write. But like, apparently The Goonies is his story. Like, he wrote that story and then gave it to Chris Columbus. Really? I always forget that he doesn't go by Christopher because of the Explorer and Murder.
Slave Trader. I'm reading the first few paragraphs of Schrader's script here. It's online.
Yeah. Do you think Schrader, like, you're gonna say that shit about me? I'm just gonna post it.
It says the very first scene is pre credits exterior sight, neither night nor day. A fog enshrouded knoll looms up from nowhere. Its outlines are hazy. An orangish glow hangs on the horizon. The wind blows. The fog passes, yet nothing becomes clearer. Is this a dream? A memory? A lost world? Or one yet to be found? Somewhere in the far reaches of space, music is playing. The notes drift through space, collide, collude, and pass on. The mood is ominous. Something is going to happen here.
I don't love that. And, you know, again, having seen the film, like, there are some moments that are kind of ambiguously night and day because of the way that, you know, unknown forces kind of light up the sky in clouds at a given point. But nah, fuck that. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is incredible. I'm going to put it like ahead of, you know, like Raiders of the Lost Ark was kind of, you know, my best thing with him. Like, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jaws are like, man, like, you did it. You made like a giant commercial movie about as well as can be done. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind is better.
Hey, I'm sold. I'll watch it. Relax.
I was surprised. I really preferred Last Crusade when we watched all of the Indiana Jones movies the last time I did. I would have sworn up and down that Raiders was best, but I actually liked Last Crusade a tad bit more.
That is not something that I have reinvestigated since college, so.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. All right, I'll listen to that. Raiders of the Lost Ark was one of my vacation VHSs.
Oh, okay.
In 1999, we got the minivan with the VCR player and the screen that came down. A lot of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And the Merlin miniseries, weirdly.
Interesting.
For me and my brother.
Yikes.
Yeah, not great. I think that was Sam Neill, though.
Yeah. Could have been worse, I guess.
Kevin?
I'll be right back.
Oh, I'm done.
Oh, you're done. I forgot you're done.
Yeah.
All right. I watched a trio of Westerns. Rewatched Unforgiven. Really great. Went up half a star for me. I really love just like Richard Harris's character in this, how he's, you know, the whole film's about myth making and storytelling and like who a person is based on reality versus what's been said about them and about their deeds. And so like Will Money, Eastwood's character, is an outlaw and a murderer and a no good, you know, and he's killed women and children, and he admits to this, and he's not doing it now, though. He's reformed now, you know. He married a nice lady who passed away. And I hated there's text on the screen at the beginning that explains that he reformed himself and married this woman, and that she died, and he's raising their children, and just trying to be like a good person.
Mm.
And the fact that her parents hate him and think that he's like a, you know, scum of the earth because of the person he was. It's just really, it's a cool idea that it melds in so well with the Richard Harris part of it, which is Richard Harris is traveling the country with a writer who's writing his biography about what a great gunfighter he is and what a great, you know, sort of Western archetypical hero he is. And Gene Hackman just annihilates the entire myth in one scene, you know, and beats the ever-loving shit out of him and arrests him and proves to the writer that this guy is a fraud and that, you know, in essence, I'm the real deal. I'm the guy. He doesn't push the writer to write about him, but the writer is very interested in Gene. Saul Rubinek plays the writer. And anyway, it's just, I saw all those themes work really well in the movie. And it's just a lot of exceptionally good acting, obviously. I mean, Hackman's like a god tier acting. And Morgan Freeman's quite good in this also. And Frances Fisher's in this. She's one of the prostitutes who hires Will Money to kill the guys who cut up the other prostitute. And I met Frances Fisher once. and was quite rude to her. I was working at a fresh market, and she came in after sort of like close to closing, and I was not happy to see her, and I didn't realize who she was until after I was rude to her. And so I was like, oh, that's the lady from Titanic. I forget, you know. But she was in town filming with William Hurt, who I also met at that time and knew. I recognized him, talked to him. But anyway, and then I watched Frontier Crucible, which is from last year, and it's directed by this guy Travis Mills, who does like right-wing coded Taylor Sheridan-esque Western, but more like not good, not as good as Taylor Sheridan's capable of doing. And he's also like, he's the guy who, I don't know if you guys have heard of this, but he directed like 12 Westerns in a year, like one every month. Like, this is like what this guy does. He like makes low budget Westerns.
What's his name?
His name's Travis Mills. But this one was interesting because it's the return of Armie Hammer in a supporting role here. And it also stars Thomas Jane. And William H. Macy is in one scene at the very beginning of the film. But they get his name on the poster probably. And this movie is pretty bad. It's a script by S. Craig Zahler, the guy who Brawl and Bone Tomahawk and so forth.
We talked about this. Why did we talk about this?
I probably brought it up last week because I was
trying
to watch it. And then I got a hold of it and watched it. And it's just a pretty dull, slow, boring movie based on a novel from the 50s. It's probably equally slow and boring. I don't know. And it's the lead actor, Miles Clohessy, is just god-awful and like a void of personality. And the lady in it, Mary Stickley, she's just horribly miscast. And she looks... Somebody said on one of the Letterboxd reviews that she looks like she's... she looks like she's looked at her phone in her life. Like, she just has the look of someone who's looked at a smartphone, and it just doesn't work. You can't picture her in this time period. And it's true. I don't know. It's just, I had some hope because of the Zahler script. Maybe there was something interesting or sort of dark here. And I mean, it does get violent, but it's not entertaining or good at all. It does look okay. I was surprised at how, like, professional it looked, because I was expecting it to sort of be like shot on handycam or something, because this guy's notoriously low budge. And then I rewatched High Plains Drifter, which I did not like as much as I remembered liking it. And Eastwood's character in this, the stranger, a lot of very problematic. He raped two different women in this movie. And it's not debatable what's going on here. Like, he's sexually assaulting these women, and I guess you're supposed to feel like they deserve it or something, because he's the ghost of this character who was killed in the town before, which is also doesn't work at all, because like everyone in the town keeps referencing the marshal who got whipped to death in the street. They all witnessed it, but none of them recognize Clint Eastwood is that guy. And I mean, it's him. He looks the exact same in the flashback. I mean, he has a beard now, I guess, but
Superman glasses.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just weird. I like the idea of it, like as like a spiritual or a supernatural, you know, ghost Western thing. I mean, I'm okay with that. I just, maybe in the hands of someone else, Eastwood doesn't seem to have a grasp on this. Mm. But yeah, sort of like Proto Crow, I wrote in my review, sort of like, you know, early version of the Crow, which is a cool idea. Like, the Crow in the Old West, that's a fun idea. I would watch that.
Mm.
But this is not good. I will never watch. Oh, and the score is like absolutely atrocious. It's like so dated. It's like a bunch of like singing saws and like guitar, you know, it's like woo, like theremins and stuff. It's really bad.
Ugh.
And there's one part where it's like a hard R, you know, like, because again, he rapes women and then like he blows people away and there's blood and stuff. But then there's one scene where a guy very clearly says the F word, but it's like muted when he says it. Like, they edited the audio out so he wouldn't say the F word. I don't know. Why?
Yeah, why?
It's so strange, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, neither here nor there.
Was this rated PG?
I think it was
two rapes, but no F word?
No, I'm pretty sure I looked it up and it was rated R. Because I was confused about that. I was like, why on earth is... Anyway, yeah, it's rated R. Anyway, that's my three Westerns. Kevin? No, JR? Sorry. Kevin doesn't have anything.
Just made it onto your Letterboxd profile. I'm a little bit like, what the fuck is happening here? Okay. I think the only... I want to say movie of note, but it's not even really of note. Oh, no, never mind. I'll go with Disclosure Day.
Okay.
As I mentioned, I do like Disclosure Day, and it is... I don't know exactly what I thought it would be, and I didn't watch any trailer past like the initial teasers, which I didn't think looked very good. Kind of just went to this because I had time to go to a movie on the Friday that it opened, and have just been struggling to like talk myself into Obsession or Backrooms. I don't really know why. I will see them both eventually. I just struggling to get there. But I thought Disclosure Day was an incredibly interesting movie in which Steven Spielberg presents ideas that I don't agree with, but makes me like wins me over emotionally. A lot of this hinges on like traditional like news feeds and an idealism about this world that I just do not agree with at all. Like, I can't relate, but still, as things are going, I'm just like, fuck, man. Like, you have made this almost, it's like, it feels like personal to him. Scenes and actors together are effective, and I just, It's just like he did it. And it reminded me of how I felt about like Tree of Life, when it's like, you know, Malick is presenting this world in which like God and the afterlife are just like a thing. They just accept it. And that movie wins me over, even though like I don't believe any of that shit. And this is not a similar movie in any way to Tree of Life, and it's certainly not as good of a movie as Tree of Life, but like Steven Spielberg kind of did the same thing, where it's just, again, a bunch of ideas and attitudes that I don't agree with that end up working on me. And Emily Blunt is really good.
Really?
Yeah.
She was my biggest concern, I'll be perfectly honest.
Oh, she shouldn't be. Like, I would be very surprised if she was the thing that you walked out hating the most. I mean, you might still dislike her, but
I'll probably hate the deer and whatever else goofy fucking Christmas scene is happening at the end of the trailer.
No, I wouldn't be like, I mean, you might still not like the way it looks, and I don't love the way it looks. Like, I do believe that it looks a certain way because of what it is. Mm-hmm. In the sense that it's not just real animals, but Josh O'Connor is maybe the problem. Like,
don't say that.
Josh O'Connor's the problem.
If there is an acting problem, I think it is him. I think like Colin Firth is given like kind of a ridiculous role that's like he has to play like a little too close to cartoony villain. But he can do that. Coleman Domingo is not given a lot to do, but is good with what he has. Both Emily Blunt and Josh O'Connor have significant others for like at least a portions of the movie. And both of them, Eve Hewson and Wyatt Russell, are quite good. And Josh O'Connor, I think, he's the character who's kind of like, he's given the most so like exposition at the beginning that doesn't work. And he's just like the least sort of like well-developed character. And I don't know. I feel like someone more attuned to working with Steven Spielberg might've been better in that role. I don't know. Maybe they just could have like, giving it some more juice.
He's the it guy, though. They have to use him.
I know. Mm-hmm. And I like him. I've liked him.
No, I know. He's great.
He's just not great in this. And by the way, I know I'm never gonna stop making excuses for this movie that I enjoyed. I know is not perfect, but I thought that I was gonna be fucking miserable. The first three scenes of the movie are so awkwardly expository. As there's action happening, especially in the first scene, there's a wrestling match somehow. I don't know how that was a choice to start, but
he watched Highlander and decided he needed to do that.
Right.
Those three scenes, and it's like this wrestling scene where something takes place. And then two scenes of Josh O'Connor and Eve Hewson talking to each other. And I was like, I got to get out of here. Like, this is going to be a fucking disaster. And it turns around like really quick. It never goes back to that feeling. But I do think like either of you in those first three scenes, I could see both of you just like shutting down, and never opening back up.
I don't know. I like wrestling. I like Eve Hewson.
It's not the wrestling. I do like Eve Hewson. I didn't realize she was in this. Who
the fuck is Eve Hewson? Like, I love how you guys know
who she was. The nurse in Nick.
She was their nurse in Nick, and I heard she was good in that.
Oh yeah, she's good.
She has a small part in Bridge of Spies. I don't remember. She is in an Apple show that Sarah made me watch. That is pretty funny, called Bad Sisters, and she is by far the highlight of Bad Sisters. She is kind of like the hot girl in the past that Jake Kelly was in love with, George Clooney. Mm. Like, you kind of get a flashback to them like flirting. Did you guys see Jay Kelly?
No.
Thank
I watched
God.
The
Thank
first
God for you.
Five. Right. I watched the first 5 minutes and I couldn't handle it.
Like, Eve Hewson is a very attractive human who's been like in fine things, and I haven't seen The Nick, which is obviously stupid of me.
Oh, she's Bono's kid.
Oh, is she?
Did you know yeah. that?
No.
She's Bono's cool. daughter.
Yeah.
That's insane.
But she gets the best scene of Disclosure Day, a scene between her and Colin Firth that is
interesting,
awesome. Loved it.
All right, dude. That's enough.
I have nothing good else to say about anything, I swear.
I like David Koepp, you know? He wrote Carlito's Way and Snake Eyes, two of my favorite movies. So.
And the most recent, Jurassic World.
Right. Well, he wrote Jurassic Park also, so it should be said. I mean, you gotta take the good with the bad, you know?
Yeah.
Black Box.
All right.
Black Bag. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, Black Bag. He did write that. He wrote Presence also.
Mm-hmm.
He's good. He's good. Yeah. He's a, you know, a
weird
he's
fucking guy.
He's like a legendary sort of Hollywood jobber. I watched Backrooms mainly because, I don't know, the marketing totally missed me on this. I didn't realize that this Renata Reznev girl was in it from the Oslo films. Mm-hmm. And I like her, so I wanted to see it. And then also the new Boards of Canada album came out, and I liked it a lot. And one of the songs was apparently used in the film. So I was like, you know what? I'll go see this movie. And it's okay. Some of it works. A lot of it doesn't. It devolves into like slasher territory at the end, which is pretty lame. Because earlier when... Again, I always think it's better to not know things than to know them. And there's a mystery here that's Cain Parsons cannot help but reveal, and it's not interesting at all when it's revealed. It takes all the fun out of it. And but prior to that, it's very creepy and effective in parts, and there's a lot of tension. A lot of tension when characters go into the back rooms, because you don't know what the fuck is gonna, you know what I mean? Like, you know, literally anything can happen because they're in this weird liminal space. And I think all that stuff works really well. And the Renata here, you know, she's doesn't have a ton to do that's all that interesting, but she does have a sort of a background thing that's in the background of this film, and it's not terrible. I think Chiwetel Ejiofor sort of has the least to do, and it's weird because he's first billed and he is like the star of the movie, but yeah, it's not great what they do with his character. Anyway, you know, see it or not.
I mean, I am going to see it.
Yeah.
I still don't know. I don't understand how I'm on such a different internet than the rest of the world. Like, I never saw a trailer for this. I had not heard about it until the week before it came out and saw it covered on some movie podcasts that I follow. And that's great. I am not a Backrooms dude. I don't know this lore at all. And, you know, I just, in my head, eventually I'm just going to make it to the most recent Mark Duplass movie.
I don't think there's the lore of it. I mean, I don't know that much about it either. All I know is that there was a photo that was posted on Reddit and like with like a little bit of text that said, you know, if you're not careful, you end up in the back rooms and you can't get out. And it turns out, like, the photo was, you know, the back room of some furniture store that was about to be torn down or renovated or something. And so this guy Cain Parsons, I guess, ran with it and made, like, short films about it and stuff. And that's why he got this gig. But, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much how much backstory there was prior to this film, and I think the backstory that's created in this film is not that interesting. And he didn't write the film either, so I don't know.
Did you see that he's a child? Like,
yeah, he's this was 20, filmed when right?
he was 19-year-old, and now he's 20.
Yeah. I mean, it's not crazy. Poorly directed or anything. I mean, it's well made and everything. I mean, I know they had a sort of a Robert Altman PTA situation. They had like another director on standby to sort of guide him.
Was it Mark Duplass?
No, it was someone else. I read about it. I don't remember. It wasn't a name, I don't think. It was just some other guy that was like.
There's like lots of producers on this. Like, was it one of them? Like Sean Levy, James Wan, Oscar Perkins.
No, it was like a journeyman guy. It was like some, and they had him, and somebody interviewed that guy, and he claims that like the only thing he helped Kane do was like Kane would come to him and say, "I have this idea to do this," and he would help him like sort of realize it. But he said he never told Kane where to put the cameras or anything like that. He didn't direct the movie. He was just trying to be real clear about that he didn't that Kane directed this movie, you know, that kind of thing. But anyway, Jerry, you got another one?
Yeah, I watched Over Your Dead Body, another 2026 movie directed by Jorma Taccone, who's one of the Lonely Island guys.
Oh, okay.
And this came across my sphere of awareness because I watched that very stupid movie that I loved. Pizza Movie, and the dudes who wrote and directed Pizza Movie, Nick Coker and Brian McElhaney, wrote this too, and I was like, Samara Weaving and Jason Segel in like comedy violent thriller thing.
I saw the trailer for this.
I can do that. And they are a couple, a married couple. Weaving is an actress. Siegel is a failed or down on his luck director, and they are going on a long weekend vacation getaway, be together. But they also very clearly hate each other, and as the trailer shows you, have each concocted a plan to murder the other, and they kind of catch themselves in this. And I thought this movie had a real chance to just kind of focus on the two of these two trying to kill each other. That would have been great, but there is an outside element that is introduced that kind of derails that, and it stays quite funny. I just, despite all my better impulses or better judgment, I like Jason Segel. I like Samara Weaving. And I mostly enjoy what's going on in this movie, even though I'm certainly not going to tell you that it's good.
Jorma Taccone had a brief stint on Girls.
I remember that.
Yeah, as an artist, he was pretty good. I like that. Okay, cool. So I just got back from Atlanta, and while I was out in Atlanta, I was staying with my cousin and her husband. And her husband immediately, when I walked through the door almost, says, "Have you seen Project Hail Mary?" And I was like, "No." And he goes, "That's the best film I've seen in the last 15 years. We're going to watch it tonight. Let's watch it." And I was like, I don't know.
You should have been straight up, "You don't want to do this with me. You do not want to do this with me. I'm not your man."
I know, right? I was trying to be nice.
John's
to
like, him. "Hello, darkness, my old friend."
I was trying to, be a team player, and anyways,
that's such an awful feeling. Like, you love this, and I'm smiling along.
He ends up sitting, and I'm like, "Well, how are we gonna watch it?" And he's like, "I'll rent it." And he goes to Amazon, and you can't rent it; you have to buy it. Ugh, and I'm like, that's too bad. And then he just buys it, but he had points or something. It made it $0. But he buys this movie, and we watch it. And I'll say that, like, you know, this just isn't my kind of thing. I understand why this is popular. It's really obvious why this is so popular. And it has a lot, it mostly everything to do with Ryan Gosling being at the center of it. And he's very, you know, he's very likable and self-deprecating and charming. But beyond that, there's nothing for me here. It's a really, really long movie about a guy stuck in space, who meets like a rock alien who can, this alien has like the ability to like create anything essentially. Like he's like a 3D printer almost. Like he can just like create objects. And but he can't exist in the same, like he breathes like ammonia or something like that. Like he can't be in oxygen. So he's constantly separated from Ryan Gosling. And which leads to some like, you know, sort of comical stuff, but also really sort of like darker things. I mean, it's a little manipulative emotionally, but and then like there's just, it's directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, so it's obviously like, you know, it has this really heavy comedic bent to it, which Ryan Gosling's great casting for, but it gets way too comedic for my taste. It's too feel good for my taste. It wants to be like hard sci-fi, like The Martian. I mean, it's getting a lot of comparisons to Martian. It's the same, you know, author of the book or whatever. Andy Weir wrote both books. But this feels a lot less hard sci-fi than The Martian felt, and it's, you don't, it just feels very like palatable to boomers. And I want to be clear, my cousin's husband is not a boomer, okay? They're not that old,
Is he Gen
but
X?
he is Gen X.
That's
But
I'm sorry to say, that's boomer light.
He's a good guy that, you know, he loves this movie, and I told him, you know, I told him all my positive thoughts about it, and I just left everything else out. So I was very trying to be real nice, but yeah, this is just not for me. It's just not my kind of thing, you know. And I can see JR watching this and giving it a 3.5.
Well, JR's going in quite biased because JR fucking hates this book.
Okay, there you, well, never mind then.
And look, my wife and I are the only people, you know, that I'm friends with on Goodreads who did not give this 5 stars. Like, I understand. I almost feel like sick, like I don't get something. But Andy Weir's characters just make me like shrivel up and want to die inside. Like, oh shucks, I'm just a middle school teacher, high school teacher who's like pretty good at science, and I'm just going out into space now. Oh God, everyone else died? Okay, I'll just be friends with a rock. Like, I cannot fucking stand these characters that are just constantly like happy narrating the challenges that they're facing. It drives me fucking crazy. And I actually was like, maybe a movie can make this better, but the reason I did not go pay to see it is definitely because I just cannot stand this book. I hate it.
If there's the saving grace, if there is one for me, is Gosling. I mean, I think he's, you just can't help but like him. Like he's very watchable, and he does a lot of heavy lifting just with his sort of casual dialogue reads, you know. And I think like the sort of crime of the film is Sandra Hüller is in the film, and she's, I don't know, she's very underused, and it's lame, and it's just a bummer, you know, because it's like she's really good in the stuff I've seen her in. And
Yeah.
you know, it's just a bummer to see her sort of like doing very little in this major Hollywood blockbuster. But
Well, I mean, she's not
you
on the ship, so how much can
know.
she be in it?
It's a lot of flashback. I don't know how the book is
Okay.
structured, but I mean the movie is 50-50. It's he's on the ship remembering what happened on Earth.
Well, that's a lot of flashback, okay.
Yeah, it's a ton.
Yeah, you know, bummer for Sandra. She got paid, presumably, so.
I mean, she's in it a lot, but she's just, she's just like, you know, she's the leader of the, she like recruits him, and then just a bunch of scenes of her being sort of a bitch.
Look,
and then singing karaoke in one scene. I don't know. It's lame. I can't do it.
This is the 134th best movie of all time, according to the Children and Idiots website. I legitimately think, just based on how this was received and how much money it made, like, this is likely our kind of like earlier in the year release Best Picture nominee. Like, you know, people are going to be eating off this movie for a long time, I think.
Well,
and I might watch it if it gets nominated for Best Picture.
Mike says it's going to win Best Picture. That's my cousin's husband. So
Mike doesn't know shit. I mean, you know, who knows? But
it could. I mean, I could. I told him I love this movie. I could see it being nominated. I doubt it'll win.
Mm.
But I mean, it is a feel good sort of.
I think that if Dune Part Three, if that's bad, that'll win. If it's good, it won't win. I think if the bad, Odyssey. The Odyssey makes a lot of money, which it looks like it will. That probably gets nominated. I don't know if it wins.
What are the outside chances that Doomsday will win?
Doomsday?
Yeah.
No chance. No. No way.
The return of Downey Jr. They can't help themselves. I heard there's an interview with Ian McKellen talking about reprising Magneto in it.
No. I think Obsession wins.
That would be nuts.
Dude, I mean, Obsession is currently, like, it's currently tracking to make enough money that it being nominated for, like, just an Oscar could happen.
Would the girl in it be nominated or something?
The girl or the screenplay, but just, like, the idea that, like, this tiny horror movie released in May could get anything would be insane. Because, you know, it's not... You know, it is now the most, the highest grossing festival acquisition ever. But like, get out a bigger movie than Obsession, which also, you know, got nominated for Best Picture and won an Oscar, and great for Get Out.
Get Out was good.
Yeah.
Get Out was good.
Okay. Do you have others? I'm done.
Everyone go watch The Underground Railroad. Barry Jenkins is good. You're Not Done. Also, I need to know why you went and saw The Breadwinner.
Oh, I, we had, you know, it's summertime. We have nothing to do. And my daughter saw this trailer when we saw the Mario movie. And she said she wanted to see it. So I love my daughter a lot. And brought her to see The Breadwinner, which, you know, it's not a good movie. But Will Forte's in it. You know, it's a little bit there. And then, like, it is just funny. Like, it's comical how much product placement there was in the film. So, like, that was fun to watch and keep track of. They should have really leaned into it. They should have done like twice as much and had like a tally card or something you could have filled out while you're watching. That would have made it more interesting. It's the return of Mr. Wonderful. You know, Kevin O'Leary is in this thing. His second big film in a few months.
That's not good.
I'm just kidding. He's in Shark Tank. He's playing himself. But yeah, it's not, you know, I'm not a Nate Bargatze fan. I don't care about stand-up comedy, and they show some of his stand-up comedy at the end, and it's a little embarrassing because it's all the bits they show are like the jokes that are in this movie. So he just like took his bits and made them into the movie. It's pretty lame. I don't know.
Ugh. This is an idea for a movie that I think looks, it's like very like early 90s coded.
Yeah.
And just looks bad. I mean, not every movie like that has to be bad, but like this one looked quite bad. Bad luck for Nate taking pictures with RFK Jr. and Donald Trump at the UFC thing.
Well, I think I think it's also 90s coded, also pretty like conservative coded, like this even the way it starts off with his narration about his wife and how she takes care of everything, and I don't know what to do, I'm just a dummy, I don't even know how to take trash out, and it's just like, you know, my wife is the best and she does everything in the house and I make the money, that's my job, and it's just like this sort of like gross Christian nationalist sort of perspective. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
that's gross.
His stand-up doesn't come off as, I mean, you could say it comes off conservative because there are clearly gender dynamics in his house, but it's mostly like his brand of comedy is like, I'm an idiot comedy. Mm-hmm. And like, he has a pretty funny story of just like people coming to his house to like replace his door and him not knowing what's going on because he's an idiot.
Yeah.
I have laughed at. And it's not because, you know, he makes all the money and his wife doesn't work. It's like, his wife gave him information and he fucking forgot it. And now there's no door on his house. He doesn't know what's going on. But yeah, I think turning that into a whole movie sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah. I mean, the movie is the former. The movie is, my wife is organized and I am unorganized, and she gets this opportunity to go do something and like create a business. And I'm not going to be part of that because I need to stay home and watch the kids. But I don't know how to watch the kids because I'm the dad. My job is to be in the salesman. I'm supposed to make the money. And I'll say that the only part that I laughed at all was at his, he's like a car salesman in the movie. And Kumail Nanjiani is the like rival salesman, and he's pretty funny. That's good stuff. Like anytime he's on screen, it's pretty good.
That's fun. I cannot relate with a movie that like presents an idea that just because like a guy has a job, he doesn't know how to do fucking laundry.
Right. Yeah.
Laundry is really fucking easy.
It's basic.
The buttons on the machines tell you what to do. They have told you what to do on those machines since the 80s, right? They're not complicated. Mm-hmm. And I've never had someone in my house do all my laundry. So
he does it. The joke is in this movie isn't that he doesn't know how to do the laundry; it's that there is no end to the laundry. He spends like 6 hours a day downstairs in the basement doing laundry because daughters use too much towels and things like
that. Never mind, I'm back in. There is no end to the laundry. Totally agree.
All right. Well. Anyway. That's our show. It's my pick next week, or next time, I should say. And we are going to watch One Trick Pony, directed by Robert M. Young, starring Paul Simon and Rip Torn. So there's that. This is the Paul Simon Passion Project, where he plays Jonah, a traveling musician who's divorced but has a kid that he's trying to reconcile with, and it's directed by the great unsung Robert M. Young, who directed Ballad of Gregorio Cortez and Short Eyes and Tramp of the Spirit. This is a movie that I watched a few years ago and talked about on the podcast, and just really, really loved, and I'm hoping that you guys will like it at least.
Oh man,
we'll see.
I only like Steven Spielberg stuff now.
Did I mention that Steven Spielberg ghost directed this, actually?
All right, so. Cool. Sounds great. Really? 5 out of 5. Let's do it.
Right. Cinematography by Dick Bush. Can't get better than that.
My sense.
Anyway, oh, same cinematographer as Sorcerer. For me.
Wow.
That movie looks okay.
Yeah, I'd say so,
it's kind of good.
All right. Anyway, until next time, you know, thanks for listening. Visit our website, filmyakpodcast@gmail.com. That's our email address. Visit our website, filmyakpodcast.com. And, you know, whatever. This episode will be up eventually.
Yeah.
And you'll hear it. It's the end. You still here? Just kidding. It's the Ferris Bueller thing. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
All right. I have to talk about the fucking bride. Great. Just jolly. Just kidding.
I mean, you don't have to. Nobody's holding a gun to your head.
I was actually mildly curious to watch that until I saw your rating. I know people have been saying it's shit.
Mm.
But it hits different when JR says it's shit, you know?
It's really... I was just kind of hoping like for something like interesting bad, like, hey, there are some ideas here. And I just thought that was not the case.